Hello, welcome to the Animation Pimpcast. My name is Chris Robinson, and today's Pimpcast features an Oscar winner. Yes, an Oscar, Academy Award winner. I know that's a big deal to some of you, so congratulations. This is your moment. This was about as close, actually, through this animator, it was about as close as I ever got to getting an Oscar mention. But it wasn't to be thus far. The subject today, or the chat-e of this Pimpcast, is a man, it's another Chris. This is our second Chris in a row. Maybe the last Chris. I don't know if there's any more Chris animators. His name is Chris Landreth, an animator who actually, like Chris Sullivan, who we featured in the Animation Pimpcast number one, is from the Chicago area, but he transplanted to Toronto, Canada, many years ago. He's probably one of the most interesting computer 3D, I don't know what your tech words are, animators going, somebody who really uses it as an art form and to articulate a personal vision. You know, his films, The End, Bingo, Ryan, you might have heard of, and his most recent film is Subconscious Password. And the following chat takes place again during the 2013 Ottawa International Animation Festival. Subconscious Password was in the official competition. And we were lucky enough to have Chris Landreth on hand during the festival. And he agreed to sit down with me in a church setting. I don't think I mentioned where we are maybe during the Pimpcast, but I mentioned it's the first time in this certain venue or space to the audience that's there. And it's in fact taking place at St. Bridget's Center for the Arts, I think it's called, but it used to be St. Bridget's Church. It's a very cool space. Maybe not the best space for sound, not really a place you could project films in there, but it's actually, having said that, what use is it for? Well, no, it's good for talks and presentations and parties, and we had a few of those. So yes, and it will cut, this Pimpcast will cut off a bit abruptly, but I'll come back and tell you that it's over. I'm still fiddling with this editing software. Anyway, here's a, this runs just under an hour. I think this is moving in the right direction here with the Pimpcast. There were fewer notes this time, and I'm, you know, lucky enough that I've known Chris for many years. And of course we had some, involvement together, around Ryan Larkin. I had some involvement in bringing Chris and Ryan Larkin together, and that led to the creation of the Oscar-winning and Ottawa Grand Prize-winning film, Ryan. And I later wrote a book called The Ballad of a Thin Man in Search of Ryan Larkin. Yes, that's a plug. Too bad. It's my Pimpcast. I can plug if I want. That's what she said. So here we go with Pimpcast, the Animation Pimpcast. Here we go with Animation Pimpcast number two, featuring Chris Landreth.
Hi, good evening.
Wow, this is strange.
This is the Animation Festival's first time ever in this venue. This is the first event ever for us in this venue. It's pretty weird. And appropriate? Fuck. I just wanted to do that. So welcome. This is the second of what I've called the Animation Pimp Cast, because these will be one-on-one chats that will later be turned into podcasts that will be presented on awn.com. I'd like to thank the National Film Board of Canada for presenting all three of our pimp casts, and that they're okay with that word pimp. It's quite surprising. Tonight, it's one-on-one with Chris Landreth. I'll read a little generic bio before we bring him up, because it's in the catalog, so it might as well be put to some use. Mr. Chris Landreth started his adult life as a mechanical engineer. It's a common animation characteristic. Until he decided in 1990 that doing animation would be more fun. And since then he's created short films, first with Alias, which is now called Autodesk. Is that true? Yeah. Then with the National Film Board of Canada, now called the NFB. His film Ryan from 2004 received the Academy Award for Best Animation Short Film. It also won the grand prize here at the Ottawa Festival. And it won 60 other international awards. Not 61, not 59, 60. That's pretty impressive. His latest film, which is in competition here in program number 2, is Subconscious Password, which has already received the Annecy Crystal for Best Short Film, and I'm sure we'll hear some buzz about it come Oscar time. We're very proud, pleased, honored, happy, humbled, confused to have with us Mr. Chris Landreth. He is now walking towards the stage.
We haven't seen each other in like 6 years, I think.
Yeah, it's been a while. What have you been doing?
Sorry.
You made that Ryan film, and then...
I've got this watching over me. So
the Lord is watching, or the Lord's son? Or?
Are there any Calvinists in the audience? Or 17th century style Puritans? Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, let's move on from the iconoclasty.
Guess for the listeners, the eventual listeners, or at least the one, we're in St. Bridget's Center for the Arts. It used to be a church. It has now been decommissioned, retired. Is there a proper word?
I think it's decommissioned, demystified.
Well, it's not a church anymore.
Yeah. So and, it's an art. It's like an art center now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
beautiful.
But you know, it's still kind of a church.
It's amazing, actually. We have a 70 stop organ looking down in this direction, and I mean, this is a cathedral practically here. It's beautiful. Anyway, hi.
So welcome to Ottawa.
Nice to be here, Chris.
Are you a spiritual person?
Yeah, I am. I don't know what that means or how I can put that into words, but yeah, I am.
What guides you?
Gratitude. Seriously. Like looking for the moments where there is gratitude, where there's just, I don't know, I mean, I'm getting flowery here, but, you know.
That's
you
okay.
You look for joy and affirmation wherever you can find it. That's what life is about. Otherwise, it's just a tedious little slog to your grave.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a good way to start.
What gives you joy?
Gives me joy. Ordinary things give me joy. Walking, the fact that I can walk, you know, the fact that I can sit here and being social, like being able to like come up with words and converse, that's great. Totally great. That's what I like.
Well, that was something you had said to me, and we were talking when we interviewed earlier in the year about Subconscious Password. You had said you were just amazed at the brain's ability. I mean, just that we could remember all these names.
Yeah.
Along with all the other.
I mean, yeah, it's the film, I don't know if you've seen the film yet or not, but the film is about the sometimes agonizing process that we go through when we're trying to remember something, in this case, like a person's name, and that is ultimately a mysterious, unknowable process that we're able to go through in order to, in the case of the film, remember the name of a person that you haven't seen in 4 years. Like, where does that come from? How do you get that information? And how do you, like, get it on through your tongue so that you're actually able to say it to your friend? Like, hi, John. That's sort of an undercurrent in the film.
I sometimes get depressed if I think of all the useless things I know. Let's say, I don't know, the history of Dick Van Dyke's movie career or little facts like that. And I just think, there's so much more that could be occupying that space.
Songs that come from, I mean, you are of a certain age like me, so like songs like that, like Give Me That Ding. I don't know if you remember
Give
that.
Me That Ding.
Give Me That, I don't know that song. The theme songs to like the Dick Van Dyke Show or Bewitched or Gilligan's Island. I mean,
yeah,
everyone knows that. But why the hell do we hold on to that stuff?
Can we stop it?
You can't, because it's coming from the emotional part of your brain. Emotion is tied with memory. The part. I mean, just getting into the parts of the brain, the hippocampus, which I actually do refer to in the film, is part of this little kernel in your brain called the limbic system. And that is what you would call the mammal part of your brain, as opposed to like the human part, which is the whole outer part. But the mammal part is all based on emotion. And getting memories back, long-term memories, involves tying those with emotions, with emotional states that you were in at the time that you remembered it. That's why, like, there's this thing like PTSD, because, you know, when you have a trauma, your entire emotional core of your brain is rewired in a bad way. And, you know, getting over PTSD is as much a neurological as it is a psychological, emotional thing, because your emotional center has been completely scrambled up. And it's because it's the emotional part of your brain is why you remember inconsequential things like TV theme songs like from your childhood. It's an emotional time, emotional thing.
What do you know about PTSD?
I don't know. Sorry.
Oh.
Is this the one with this one? Okay. Is that better? I
don't know. He says it's better, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like it was fine before, but...
it seems quieter now.
Yeah? I mean, can you hear me in the back row okay?
Yeah, Jeez. It's like all or nothing here.
All right, I'm guessing you can hear me now. But like, I mean, I like being able to just not yell. PTSD. I have a friend who's, like, one of the... She actually runs a PTSD institute. She's one of the leading psychotherapists in traumatology. And I know a little bit about that through her. Her name's Anna Baranowski. Google that. So yeah, the film Subconscious Bastard has a lot of psycho shit in it, psychobabble or neurobabble, but actually some of it is actually true, or at least true as far as like what people know about brains. That's what I like about it.
Some of it isn't true?
Oh, some of it is not true. Some of it is, I mean, it's like, yeah, a lot of it is completely bullshit. And that's the thing about fiction, is truth and bullshit mixed together.
Take your memory now back.
Let's take
your memory back to your earliest days.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your upbringing and
I grew up in
your
the
parents,
suburbs.
Where you grew up and all that.
Yeah. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. My dad worked for a single company all of his adult life. He graduated from Northwestern University in 1946. got a job with Kraft Foods in 1947 and stayed with Kraft Foods until the day of his retirement in 1993 or 94 or something like that. Just ridiculous, like, company man loyalty.
What did he do there?
He was a sales guy. He sold Kraft food.
Kraft dinner?
Yeah, Kraft. Oh, yeah. Kraft sold all sorts.
Like
you're
going around to grocery stores or whatever that?
I mean, at the time, we moved to Chicago for and when I was 5 years old. That's some of my earliest memories. My earliest memory is my pet golden retriever throwing up in the back seat of the car as we were moving from Richmond, Virginia to Chicago, Illinois. And yeah, it went all downhill after that.
Were you born in Chicago or Richmond?
No, I was born actually in Hartford, Connecticut. And then my dad, because he was a salesman, was moving around like a ping pong ball, and we went along with him. So I don't remember any of that. And then, we were in Richmond, moved to Chicago when I was five, and that's where I grew up. So, yeah, that Northbrook, Illinois, a suburb that didn't exist until around the time we moved there. So it's like just no trees, cul-de-sacs, houses that had just been built out of nothing on farmland, and that's where we lived, and that's where I grew up. And my mom was a housewife, stayed home, and just had the TV on all day. That's all she did. She hated being there, and she was a housewife, and her therapy was game shows. She watched Password from the time I was like 4 years old. I saw it in black and white when it first came out, and then the day that it went color was a big day, because that influenced my parents' decision to actually get a Zenith Chromacolor TV set. That was a big day in our house.
Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister.
What's the age difference there?
My oldest brother is 2 years older than me, younger is 4 years younger, and youngest sister is 8 years younger than me. We were all born in the 60s.
What was life like, the six of you, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know. Life was
harmonious?
Between my siblings, yeah, totally harmonious. Between my parents, no. My mom was a drunk. That's a kind of a pejorative term, calling someone a drunk. She was seriously alcoholic during probably about by the time when I was 10 years old and onward. She was really drunk pretty much all the time.
So watching the game shows and having wine or?
No, vodka.
Vodka?
Vodka. Starting it at around 10, 11 o'clock in the morning.
Hardcore.
Impressive. Yeah. Vodka, actually, weird. Vodka just with skim milk. This much vodka and about that much skim milk. Never seen that before.
Is that a skinny white Russian or?
No, it's not even a white Russian. I don't know what it is. Anyway, that was part, yeah. But
were you, were you aware of the drinking when you were young?
Yeah, totally. We were all aware of that. And it has run in my family. Grandparents, alcoholic. So it is. I've kind of come to see the physiological part of. I mean, like the physical part of that. It's a genetic, or it can be a genetic thing. And there it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how long did you live in this area?
I moved away to go to college. When I was 17, and I was there, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years, something like that, and moved downstate to Urbana, Illinois, and that's where I started doing engineering, but eventually started being an artist. I didn't start being an artist until very late, and I wasn't like a child prodigy or anything like that, nothing like that.
Did you have an active life when you were a kid, though? Were you doing sports and things, or were you watching TV?
No, I was really sedentary. I wasn't a sport guy at all, no. I was a dweeb. I was hopelessly dweeb-ish. And I dabbled in computer stuff, and I did a lot of art on my own, but I never shared it. It was like personal sketchbooks. Nobody was interested in seeing this. I changed a lot after I moved away. I think I became the person that I am now. I mean, like, people will tell you a certain age, when you ask them a certain age, that they became the person that they are. But I don't think I became the person that I am now until I was well into being an adult, not when I was a kid.
What do you think? What, just getting away from?
Yeah.
Were your parents, well, I guess there wouldn't have been, your mom wouldn't have been that strict, but.
Yeah. It was a combination of getting away, being with weird artistic left-wing people, experimental people. I don't know how else to describe that, but yeah, falling in with the wrong crowd. Yeah, no, I don't.
It's just probably the right crowd, really.
The right, wrong, whatever crowd. Yes, in the 60s and 70s, that would have been the wrong crowd. But these are, I mean, a lot of these people are still very. I'm very close to. So I guess that's when I started being the person that I am.
And are your parent? Well, I know your mother's not alive anymore.
Yeah, she passed away 14 years ago.
14 years ago.
Yeah, my dad's still around.
Yeah,
he's doing good.
Is he? Watch your films, and
he's in my film. He's actually in. He's one of the people in the audience in the game show studio audience. I videoed him. I just did some cheap video of him and composited his head onto into the crowd there. He's very proud of that. He loves that.
And proud of you in general. Proud of the films.
Yeah. He is not a particularly artistic person himself. He's a salesman. I wouldn't be able to bring him to an art museum and be patient for more than 5 minutes with that experience. But yeah, he trusts me. He trusts that what I'm doing is making some impact out there.
What do your siblings do, and are you still close with them?
Yeah. My older brother is he's a jazz guitarist, and he ekes out a living in Colorado, doing what he's doing there. He teaches, performs, and records. He's like a studio musician out there. My younger brother, Jack, is in radio, like talk radio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's like a mercenary. And I say that like politically, because he's produced for Rush Limbaugh, and he's also produced for, Penn Jillette.
Okay.
Yeah, it was great, yeah.
That's an odd.
Yeah, so no, it's odd. He has no political affiliation whatsoever, but he is really a pro in radio, and so he's a PD, program director for like a big chain of stations based out of Kansas City. My youngest sister is the left-wing social person of our group, and she's working for reproductive rights down in Rochester,
okay.
or from here down in Rochester, New York.
You're saying your brother ekes out a living. I think people would probably, especially in animation, you know, you're considered one of the A-list animators, made it big, you've won an Oscar. How are you making a living?
I do from film to film. When I am directing a film, creating a film with the National Film Board, I get paid a stipend, and it's enough for me to pay the mortgage on my house, which I just paid off, actually. We now own our house, yes.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that was good. And in between that time, I eke. Which I found out is a old English, is one of the few words, eek, that that has survived early English. It's one of the oldest words that still exists. Love using it, yeah.
What was its original? Has the meaning changed over the years?
No, it is actually what it is, like to just barely get by, to eek.
To eek.
Oh. Eek, yeah. But I do teaching as well. And the big thing that I do in teaching is a master class on faces. So I work on my own to line up gigs doing this, and I teach, for example, at the University of Pennsylvania, doing a semester class with the design center there. I just came back, well, just 3 months ago, came back from China. I did a version of this master class for a institute called the Detao Institute in Shanghai and also in Beijing. I've taught at Georges Méliès School in Paris, DreamWorks in India and in California. But that's what I've put a lot of my energy into is teaching about this particular thing, about faces, about what faces, I mean, not just animating them, but...
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
It's...
The face fascination.
Yeah, it's face fascination. Fascination. Sorry. When I was getting into CG, when I was working at Alias, now Autodesk, when I was developing this, software, Maya, I was really spending a lot of time making the software, or being part of the design of the software so that it could do, character animation, but in particular, that it could do face animation. And, I'm actually quite proud that those tools that I was working on then, helping to put into the software are still... They're largely intact and are still largely used even now, 15 years later, in the way that they were originally designed. But I was, when I was doing Bingo at that time, that was, the real test for being able to use this software in order to make character face animation work well. Over that time, I've been, starting with that time, I've been just obsessed with what faces do, what their expressions are. And I'd say that I'm particularly wondrous, what's the word, wonderfied, wondrous, or whatever, on how people react. Like what you just did right there, when you were kind of shrugging there, is that you were bringing the corners of your mouth down at the same time that you were bringing your forehead up. I'm sorry, I don't want to dwell on that or make you self-conscious or anything, but that's the kind of thing that when you are animating or trying to get some real character into your character's face, that you really want to know those little tiny things, not the big things, not the Bugs Bunny kind of or Roger Rabbit kind of stuff, but the really tiny things that that you would call micro expressions.
Why is that so important for you to try and capture, in an art form where you could do anything, make it as unrealistic as possible, capture this hyper reality, or
because for me, like in the films that I've done, I like to put unrealism in there, but I don't particularly like to do that with the person's personality or the character's soul. That's where I want to be realistic. I want to make a character realistic in the sense that that character, he or she, is believable in a human way. And to do that, not all, but most of that believability comes in the face and in the tiny little things that a face does when he or she is just hanging out or just listening or just responding. That person, that character, could be very, very, very emotional, but there's very, very little in the face. But just enough, if you get just enough of the intense emotion that's happening underneath. Like in my class, I show a lot of real life videos, not just live action, but actual documentary videos.
Yeah.
And there's one video of a girl, a little girl, who up until the age of like 5 or so, has this horrible cleft lip. Like she's like, her face is just mangled from a cleft lip. And she has an operation. And the operation is completely successful. And you see her like the day after the operation. And you know, her lip is sewed up, and she looks absolutely like great. She looks beautiful, beautiful, now a beautiful, brand new, beautiful 5-year-old girl. And in this video clip, by this charity organization that does cleft lip surgery, shows her looking in the mirror for the first time and seeing that she doesn't look weird anymore. She looks like a beautiful 5-year-old girl. And I mean, what you might expect from that is that she would be like very joyous, like, oh wow, you know, like beautiful, like overwhelmed in emotion. But she doesn't do that. She just looks at the reflection, her new reflection, and you just see that her look of wonder, the eyes relax, like the eyelids come down, showing that she's comprehended what she now realizes what she's looking at, this new face of hers. And then you see just very, very slight raising of the corners of her mouth. At the same time, you see her jaw very, very slightly open, at the same time that you see her forehead relax. And that's all she does. It's just nothing at all. But it's enough, because we as human beings are so hardwired to see even the slightest amount of change in a face, that you know that she is feeling pure, wondrous gratitude, joy at that moment. And it's just a case of less being more in this case. And that's what I, as you know, people, there's a couple of people here know about my class, and they'll tell you that's a big thing that I focus on in order to get that, as I say, realism in people's personalities to come out. I like teaching this because I don't see this being taught a whole lot, and I think it's a big thing, big things for animators to really know about, to get something out of.
I remember when I first saw Ryan, and it's broken up, and the character is, you nailed the sort of shaky lip or quivering lip. And that was quite a moment of...
There's another video that I show in this class of, I don't know if you're familiar with what Andy Warhol did, these things called screen tests, where you would have, people come to the factory and that they would, just stand and sit in front of a camera and do nothing. And there's one of Bob Dylan in 1965. He comes around and he sits in front of Andy Warhol's camera for a minute, and the job is, he's told, don't do anything. And so he does. He just sits there and he diligently keeps his face still, but he does that thing that Ryan did, this, a couple of times. And there is in that a subtext, and it was definitely the case with Ryan and definitely the case with Bob Dylan too, which is that kind of twitching, involuntary twitching, is really loaded. There's a real loaded, tense aspect to that. And we look at Bob Dylan on the screen there, and it's like there's no mistaking that people look at this and they clearly Bob Dylan is in a really tense state. He's in a state of profound discomfort, and you see that in that clutching of his mouth and the fact that his eyes are darting around and not looking at the camera. That there's this real sullen, uncomfortable aspect to him. And as it turns out, that was actually a moment in which he was ending his friendship with Andy Warhol. Like there was a big scene that happened right after that screen test was over, that Bob Dylan stormed out of the place, took one of Andy Warhol's paintings, and they never spoke to each other again. And it was this big drama, big dish drama happening with Edie Sedgwick, the factory girl. Yeah. And it was like the end of a friendship.
It's not everybody would notice these things in faces.
Yeah.
Where did this fascination sort of begin?
It's part of, because of being an animator, because really? That's what I wanted. I don't know how, I'm not going to say how well I've succeeded in doing that in characters, like in films like Ryan and my other films. But what I've really tried to do, and the reason why I've paid so much attention there, is because I want my characters to be real. I want them to be believable. It can be unrealistic, as you say, fantastic, and everything else, even their bodies and in the appearance of their faces, in the case of Ryan. But as far as their expressions go, that, for me, is something that is really important to nail.
Do you study your, I mean, you're frequently a character in your films.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you study your own face quite
a
bit?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, in a detached kind of way. Like, I mean, I teach about the anatomy. Like, I have students actually, you know, students in my class do spend time in front of a mirror or in front of, you know, a camera where they can see themselves. And, you know, I have them flex each of the different muscles in the face. And get to know what those muscles are. And when you're acting, whether you're animating or actually, I think whenever you are an actor, but particularly when you're an animator, it's really great when you are acting stuff out in front of a mirror and you want to impart that onto the animation that you put on your character. When you're crying or grimacing like that, where do you feel it in your face? What muscles are actually being tensed up? And if you know, if you can feel in your face where the tension is when you're in a, whether you're smiling or crying or being angry or whatever, then you know how to put that directly onto your character, and you know how to, excuse me, you know how to feel what your character is feeling. I mean, it's kind of a cerebral thing to know the muscles, and I teach them what the muscle names are. At first, it's cerebral, but then it becomes, I think, what I've seen when I've worked with animators on my films, is that they start to feel emotionally through the muscles that they're flexing, like when they're acting in front of a mirror, so that they can, you know, keyframe stuff on their characters' faces. So yeah, I think it's a good exercise and a good course in I mean, not just animating, but like acting through animation, which, I mean, animation is acting in its heart. That's what it is. Yeah.
Now you didn't start out wanting to be an animator.
No.
Went into engineering. How did?
I know, it was weird.
How did all that?
Excuse me.
Not as weird as it seems, though. There are a lot of animators I've found who've come from these odd backgrounds. I think there's some Estonians who've come from electrical engineering background
stuff. Yeah. Particularly like computer or software engineering. I was coming from mechanical engineering, and there really isn't that much of a connection. I didn't like segue gracefully from mechanical engineering into animation. It was a complete break, I would say. I got my master's degree, Esther, in something called theoretical and applied mechanics, which is actually like a program that's a blend between physics and mechanical engineering. So I was doing a lot of theoretical stuff, fluid mechanics. And at the time, this was the late 80s, the only jobs you could get in that field were in military stuff in the States, like military contracted jobs with, you know, General Dynamics, General Electric, McDonnell Douglas, sometimes with direct contracts with the Atomic Energy Commission. I had my person who was working in the lab with me, the only job he could find, because he couldn't get a security clearance because he was a foreign national, was actually modeling nuclear explosions. So he would go out to the Nevada desert where they were still doing nuclear explosion tests and model them. That's what he did. So I didn't want to do that, and so I decided I was going to find something else to do.
What would that involve, modeling?
Modeling? Actually, computer modeling, like being able to predict, given a certain megaton size of a nuclear explosion, how big a crater it would carve out, what's the impinging downdraft would be of the firestorm that would go away, but then the vortex would come back, and what the force of that vortex, how many newtons per square meter would, you know, from that vortex coming down and coming back and, you know, basically crushing everything in its path.
And you didn't want to do that?
No, I didn't want to do that. Yeah. Just not my type. So what what people in my department were telling me was that I was looking at unemployment. And I decided, fine, I'll be unemployed. And at that time, a guy named Art Duransky, who was one of the first people to start a company doing computer graphics, he did started a company called Triple I. Nobody knows who they are now, but they did a few of the special effects in Tron, 1982. They were one of the Tron people. And he came and he gave a talk on computer graphics. This was in the 80s. And I decided this is what I wanted to do. And there was this program starting up at the University of Illinois, where I was, in doing just simple, easy, very primitive, by our today's standards, primitive CG stuff. And I got involved in that, and I quit my job doing like research assistant stuff with the university. So I quit that and lived off of savings for a year, and learned how to use this program, Wavefront, and made a little 2-minute film called The Listener, and that's sort of when I first started doing facial stuff, and. Ron Diamond, who was working with Liquid Television at the time,
right? Yeah,
saw the film and showed on Liquid TV back in 1991 or 2 or something like that. And
that was showing on MTV, wasn't it?
It was showing on MTV. Yeah. It had. I think that show's biggest claim to fame was Dog Boy.
Dog Boy.
You remember Dog
right,
Boy?
Yeah.
Dog Boy was great. This character with just this plastic head, sort of a Max Headroom kind of.
Henry Selick got his. There's a few animators that got their.
Yeah, got their start with there. Liquid TV. Yeah. So that intoxicated me for good.
You're still in Chicago then.
I was still around Chicago then.
Around, yeah.
Yeah.
You're now in Toronto.
Yes.
That's
moved there. 20. Oh God. I am coming up on 20 years and living in Toronto now, longest I've lived anywhere, like, by far.
Was it the Alias Wavefront?
Yeah. Alias brought me to Toronto. So I came. They offered me a job as a sort of, they called it an expert user, or just kind of like a person who would somebody who was would pretend to be an animator.
Pretend?
Seriously, it was a pretend job. It was all about pretending, because at that time, Alias was a CG company making software, and at that time, the software they were making was pretty much for like modeling things, for creating models of things, and nobody was using it for animation, and they wanted to break into that market, so they decided that it would be good to hire a pretend animator.
So you're like a guinea pig in a way.
They hired me to be like a guinea pig, but I decided that I would kind of make a deal with people in the animation part there, which was, you know, rather than just be a guinea pig testing the software, let me test the software. I said, let me test the software in a way that makes sense. Of course, I had an ulterior motive in saying that, which is, I'll make short films. And
that was a pretty sweet gig.
Yeah, that worked out.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a win. That was a win-win situation because, yeah.
Was it The End and Bingo?
Yeah, The End and Bingo. I made.
I mean, it was a pretty sweet deal for them, too.
It was a sweet deal for them because, yeah. The software that came out of my doing that was strong, good software. And it was a really good deal for me. Not only did I get to make short films, but I got to complain a lot. It was my job to complain, right? So, I mean, like when I did Bingo, it took about a year and a half to do Bingo because a lot of what I was doing during that part, time was filling out bug reports, like these one-page little forms that you'd fill out with a description of each bug. And any given day, I would find up to maybe 100 bugs. And Fill out these forms. But
what would some of the bugs or the complaints be?
Everything. Oh, like at the beginning. Yeah, no, at the beginning. Doing Bingo was great because it was the first film to use Maya.
Yeah.
But Maya at that point was so, it was beta software. And when I first started working with this, I was very attracted to the idea of like using this is cutting edge, this is the latest and greatest, this is the bee's knees of software. But when I started like trying to model a clown, because the film has clowns in it, software would crash. So then I would try modeling not the whole clown, but just the clown shoe. Software would crash. So, okay, clown shoe is not working. How about something that sort of looks like a clown shoe, but it only has like a few points in it? Software would crash. Okay, that's four bug reports right there. Okay, so fifth attempt. I'm just going to bring up a sphere. Like when you start off using, when you create something in a CG software package like Maya, you start with these things called primitives, right? And everything that you see, whatever it is modeled, pretty much comes from a primitive to start off with. And the simplest primitive is a sphere. So you bring up a sphere and you move it across the screen and software crashes. That's the sixth bug report. By now, rather than model a clown, you've now spent half a day trying to just move a sphere across the screen and the software crashes. That is how working on this film Bingo started. And then just slowly.
You sound frustrated even now.
Oh no, it's a great story. Yeah. That is how it happened. And then slowly. I mean, you stay with it, or at least.
I picture like all these little scientist guys running around at your.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yes, Mr. Landry. Yes.
Yeah. It was PTSD for everyone. Anyone who went through that will tell you what it was to go through that. But what came out of that was this. And amazing piece of software that 14 years later is still more people are using that than pretty much anything else right now, and that is because of the PTSD that people went through. Seriously,
it was a tense environment.
Yeah, no, totally tense. The management was passing out. Like my guy who's running the program, Kevin Tureski, was passing out these little foam things, not foam things, but these silly putty things that people could get a grip on. Stress ball. Yeah, stress ball. And the place was littered with these completely deformed stress balls, crushed, with the stuff oozing out of them. This carpeted floor was littered, still stains on the carpeted floor from these stress balls.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just still feel the emotion so strongly still from you. This was 20 years ago.
This was 15 years ago. Yeah.
And the end, did it win or is it nominated?
Yeah, it got nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah.
95 or 96 or something.
And you won it with Ryan, and there's such a mystique about the Oscars.
Yeah.
But really,
I don't know what it is.
Aside from the short-term sort of attention, what benefit, does it?
No, it's more of a curse than a benefit. The benefit is that there's prestige, and you're an Oscar winner for the rest of your life after that. As far as what it actually did for my career, I think Chris Wedge, who also won an Oscar for Bunny a few years before that, said
there
was a three-week window right after the Oscars in which you either get something or you don't. In his case, he because he was with Blue Skies, he had cemented this deal with Fox Pictures and ended up doing Ice Age, etc. I didn't really do that. It wasn't really in something that I was even seeking to do. So I'm not doing at this moment anyway. I haven't done any.
There were some possibilities, weren't there, after Ryan?
Yeah, I was asked to direct a film with Opus, the penguin, from Bloom County. I actually did stay in touch about that, and then that got that got kiboshed. It was actually a Weinstein project. I don't know. After that point, though, I was, as I was saying, starting to work on this course material, and I wasn't really feeling like doing that. I think I am a little bit more now interested in the idea of doing something larger, but at that point, I was in love, and still am in love with short films and doing short films, and the freedom, the liberty that that has of not having to deal with either the finances of a short film or the three-act structure that you generally have to follow with a feature film. And yeah, I've enjoyed that.
There's Opus, was it Opus the Penguin?
Yeah, Opus the Penguin, yeah.
That might have been a bit of a different road for you.
I can't imagine it today that I would have done that. That's why it never really happened.
And I was just thinking of like commercial projects. You briefly worked for Nelvana, didn't you?
Yeah.
What did you do?
You were one of the few people. Now these people.
Now everyone knows.
Yeah. Yeah, I was there for 9 months.
And what did you do there?
I did a proof of. I don't. That's kind of highfalutin. We did a short film of what was maybe to be, what was hopefully to be Puff the Magic Dragon, right, with Jackie Paper as this cool 5-year-old boy, and it was awful. Like the film that we ended up making was awful, because it was that film, and I think people at Nelvana will tell you where we really, really first encountered the uncanny valley in a really bad, not good way. And our Jackie Paper character was anatomically correct and creepy as all fuck get out.
What for the people in the audience and at home who might not know what the uncanny valley is?
Raise your hand if you have not heard of the uncanny valley. Okay, so yeah, a few of you. So a lot of you do know what that is. I'll try to describe that. The uncanny valley is what you see in a film like Polar Express, or Mars Needs Moms, or maybe A Christmas Carol. Films where the characters are...
Creepy as fuck, I think you said
creepy
earlier.
Creepy as all fuck, get out, creepy, yes. When a the phenomenon is actually kind of a strange phenomenon. It's called a valley. I suppose I could trace it out with my finger here. There's this graph that people know about, the uncanny valley know about, where the horizontal axis is realism, the character is how realistic the character is, and the vertical axis is how much you like that character. And there's this graph that, like, if a character is very simple, like a stick figure, it's not very realistic, so it's that way on the horizontal axis, and you don't really know that character or like it very much, in which case there's no likability to it, unless it's a Don Hertzfeldt stick figure, in which case it's off the map. Don Hertzfeldt's the outlier there. But as you can draw this graph that if a character gets more realistic, like Snow White is up here, more realistic to look at, therefore further along that way, and more likable, therefore further up this way. And then you go up to like Pixar characters, and they're pretty realistic, and they're pretty, they do darn good stories. But then you get into more realistic characters, like say Polar Express characters. They get more realistic, but they don't get more likable. They get less likable. So there's a sudden drop in how much you like the characters. And if they look too realistic without them actually being real, then that word creepy comes up. And in the case of some characters that I've done, all fuck get out creepy. That's the uncanny valley, that little dip there and that likability graph there. And so the Uncanny Valley has gotten a really bad name, and a lot of people, it's actually pretty, like I think 30 Rock, show 30 Rock actually had a thing about the Uncanny Valley on it. So it's kind of a popular culture term now. People know about that creepy aspect of characters being too real without actually being real people. And I like going into that creepy area. And sometimes I hope when I do real characters and go into that uncanny valley, which I've done on purpose and on a lot of occasions, like my last film, Subconscious Password, that there's actually a reason that actually serves the story. And that's what I was trying to do with like the game show characters in this film.
Well, you can expand on that a bit.
Yeah. But, sorry, you going to...
Well, no, I was going to say maybe you can expand on that a bit.
I mean... For those of you who haven't seen the film, as I said, it goes into the subconscious mind of the protagonist, this poor fella who can't remember his friend's name as he's trying to go into his hippocampus part I was mentioning before, and we go into this game show in his hippocampus, and in that game show you encounter different parts of Charles himself, and the host of the game show is his superego, the Freudian part of your mind that keeps you in line. And so the host, the master of ceremonies, and Charles himself, both, they look realistic, right? They've got that kind of polar expressy kind of realism to them. When I was doing the story and carrying through the story, I was trying to get them to look real, but I was not trying to get them to be, like that you would be fooled into thinking that they were real people. And unlike Ryan, where all the faces are all mashed up or weird or manipulated, they're not with those characters in Subconscious Password. So they're technically in that uncanny valley. And it's kind of a risk that I think I'm taking a risk with that, because on one hand, if people don't sort of get what that's about, they'll have the same kind of negative reaction that they would have to something like, Polar Express. But in this film, Subconscious Password, they are in that uncanny valley because that is, I think, the way that we, in our subconscious minds, in our emotional, in our emotionally driven subconscious minds, actually formulate the world. Like when you have when you look at someone, the person that you're having conversation with, and you have a good time with that person, and then you end your time, your lunch or your date or whatever together, and you go home and you're thinking of that person, the person you have in your mind's eye is a pretty good reproduction of that person. You can remember, if you're an artist, you'd be able to probably sketch their face pretty realistically. But it cannot be the person himself or herself. It's a projection of that person, a person that is a real realistic reproduction without actually being real. So what might that be like if you depict that in a film? And that's what that's what I was curious about in having those realistic depictions of, in this case, myself.
You,
of me, yes.
Which is even,
So, and that's another thing about the risk that I think I'm taking there, is that I'm going into, I'm creating these possibly creepy looking characters. Who better to do that with than myself? I've used the word guinea pig before, but if anyone's going to be subjected to that self and, have an honestly done character that's nonetheless in this uncanny valley thing, it might as well be me. I don't think that you would look at either Charles or the host, who are both models of my face, and think that it was actually me, but close enough to being me that you get the connection without it being actually a real reproduction of like me acting in live action. I think there's something in that, there's a sweet spot there, that if it were actually like me as an actor in there doing that live action, that something would really be lost in what I'm trying to get into the film, this kind of fantastical world for those who've seen the game show Password, looks a lot like Password, but it's not quite there. It's beyond there, or it's not in that real game show area. That's sort of it.
Well, that is the end of the Animation Pimpcast chat with Chris Landreth. Sorry, it ended a little abruptly there. I didn't want to get into, you know, all the Q&A stuff. And I'm a bit of a rookie when it comes to the editing software. And it was a little too... I couldn't quite get it right. So I just went to silence after the last question. So I hope you enjoyed that. I thought that was a pretty engaging chat. Chris is a great speaker. Very smart guy. And we'll be back next month with number 3 in our Animation Pimp cast. And that will feature a well-known Australian claymation animator who has he won? I think he has won an Oscar, or he's been nominated. Because, you know, I know that's important to you guys. So thanks for listening, and we'll chat again in a month.
And I'm using too many words.